From the city of Urbana, presenting the local farmers market at the square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, food, and original works of art, located in the southeast lot of Lincoln Square, downtown Urbana. Information at 344-2444. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, offering a collection of products from more than 30 third world countries, from Vietnamese ceramics and textiles to Bolivian musical instruments and international home decor.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. This afternoon, we were scheduled to talk with Carol Burke. She's a folklorist and the author of Camp All American, Hanoi Jane and the High and Tight, Gender Folklore and Changing Military Culture. But we haven't been able to reach her, so we will reschedule this. Meantime, we'll dip into the archives and we'll rebroadcast an interview from May of this year when we talked with Jay Feldman, author of When the Mississippi Ran Backwards. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Early in the 19th century, the Mississippi River Valley was hit with a series of catastrophic earthquakes dubbed the New Madrid earthquakes. It's estimated that some of the quakes would have measured near or greater than an 8 on our current Richter scale. The scale of the earthquakes that began in December 1811 was bigger than what San Francisco experienced in the 20th century. In the book When the Mississippi Ran Backwards, Empire, Intrigue, Murder, and the New Madrid Earthquakes, Jay Feldman tells the story of the quakes, the chaos they caused, and their impact on American history. He says, quoting here, "The United States was at a turning point, one of those defining moments in history when forces converge so powerfully that something has to give. This was true geologically as well as historically. It was almost as if the earthquakes were a symbol of the turmoil of the times." Jay Feldman is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in many publications, including Smithsonian Magazine, Newsweek, The New York Times, Sports Illustrated, and Gourmet. He's also written for television, film, and stage. His book, When the Mississippi Ran Backwards, Empire, Intrigue, Murder, and the New Madrid Earthquakes, is published by the Free Press. Jay Feldman, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Pleasure to be on.
What led you to look back to this period of American history and write about these earthquakes?
That's usually the first.
Yeah.
I had just finished a historical novel. Well, let me back up a little bit. Where I live in California, earthquakes are always a subject for conversation. And about 8 years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, a friend of mine and I were casually talking about earthquakes, and he mentioned, did you know that there was a large earthquake around St. Louis about 200 years ago? Well, no, I had never heard about that. So I did some quick research, just very quick, and found out that not only was there an earthquake, mm-hmm. there was a major series of earthquakes which went on for 4 months, and they were called the New Madrid earthquakes. And I kind of filed this in the back of my mind and thought, well, that might be a real interesting setting for a historical novel at some point, and kind of connect it with the Lewis and Clark exposition. It was just a vague idea. About 2 or 3 years after that, I had just finished another historical novel, which is set in a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II and focuses on baseball in the camp. And will be published actually next spring by Triumph Books. Shameless plug. It's called Kay Sefton and the American Dream, and it'll be out next spring. Anyway, I had just finished that novel, and I was looking around for a new project, and these earthquakes kind of surfaced from the back of my mental filing cabinet, and I thought, let me take a look at that. So I started doing some serious research. And a few things jumped out at me right away. Number one, I saw most important probably, is that I couldn't write this book as fiction. It was just too far-fetched. The confluence of forces and events, the coincidences that existed around these earthquakes were just way strange. You know, truth is stranger than fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And that cliche really applied in this case. So that was the first thing that I realized about it. The other thing is, and I'm glad that you read that section that you did, because I think you probably found one of the most important passages in the book, is that these earthquakes came to represent for me, they were kind of a metaphor for the turmoil and the upheaval that was going on the early frontier at the time. Up until 1803 and the Louisiana Purchase, the Mississippi River was the western boundary of the United States. So this is just 8 years after that. We're just at the beginning of westward expansion beyond the Mississippi River. And it was a very, very unsettled time. I mean, just about anything could happen and did. So there was the, you know, the symbolic meaning of the quakes. And then the third thing that I noticed was that so many of the issues and themes that I found in the stories around the quakes, the social and political history of the times, were so similar to issues and themes that we are still dealing with as Americans 200 years later. So I said to my agent, hey, I've got a great idea for this book. And he said, yeah, it sounds good. Go ahead and try it out. And that's how I came to write it.
Yeah. Back to the idea of truth being stranger than fiction, you also found this amazing cast of characters here, true flesh and blood people who are one's more amazing than, you know, could anybody be more amazing than that? You turn the page and go, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there were a lot of bigger-than-life characters in the early years of the Republic, because I think things were so wide open and it was so new, and, you know, there were many people who saw the opportunities and rushed into the, you know, the vacuum that was created by westward expansion and the early, you know, the early time of the country putting itself together. We tend to study, or history is tended, they tend to present it to us in school as war to war. First there was this war, then there was that war, then we went to another war. And the times between the wars are often overlooked. And in this case, the time between the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812 is not an era that has been, you know, delved into in any great detail, because everything was rushing towards that War of 1812, which many contemporaries regarded as the Second American Revolution, but I think probably in hindsight a better way of saying it is it was the war that consolidated the American Revolution after the War of 1812 in 1815. British, French, and French claims on the United States were pretty much finished. Native American resistance throughout the Ohio and Mississippi Valley, and southeastern United States, with the exception of the Seminoles, who actually carried on until the middle of the 19th century. But except for the Seminoles, Native American resistance was wiped out. It was finished. And 5 years after the end of the War of 1812, when the Spanish were driven from Florida, pretty much that consolidated the revolution. And from the eastern seaboard to the Gulf of Mexico and the Mexican border over to the end of the Louisiana Purchase up to the Canadian border was now all incontestably U.S. land. Of course, there were many more Indian wars that had to be fought, but the foreign powers that had claims on North America or at least the United States, were gone.
Yeah, it's interesting to think of the War of 1812, as you say, really set the policy that would be known as Manifest Destiny in stone.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, going back to this period that falls between the American Revolution and the War of 1812 and then the Civil War, you know, we see a young nation and a young nation struggling with one thing we've talked about already here, Indian relations. We've just touched on it, and slavery. And what you do here in this book is bring these issues into view for readers in the stories you tell of the people of the time, the Shawnee chief, Tecumseh, and two nephews of Thomas and Jefferson. You want to sketch for us the outline
Sure.
of their stories?
And particularly as they apply to the earthquakes, because the earthquakes are the central organizing factor in the book. Tecumseh had set out to form a pan-tribal confederacy to resist the land grab by the federal government. This had been tried before. There were other Native American chiefs like the Ottawa Pontiac and the Mohawk Joseph Brant, the Creek chief Alexander McGillivray, but nobody had the success that Tecumseh had. It was partly by the force and charisma of his personality, and partly by the nature of the times, that many warriors from a number of different northwestern tribes were drawn into the Confederacy. He set out in the fall of 1811 on a recruiting trip to the southeastern tribes, the Choctaw, Chickasaw, Cherokee, and Creek nations, where he met with less success than he had up north. And in one visit to the Creek, a particular village of Creek, he was having trouble enlisting this one particular chief who he wanted very, you know, much to sign up for this because he was an influential person. So in frustration, finally, Tecumseh said, "Look, I know why you're resisting here. You don't think that the Great Spirit sent me. Well, I'll tell you what. I leave here, I'm going to travel up to Detroit, and when I get there, I'm going to stamp my foot on the ground, I'm going to knock down every house in this village." And then he left. The Creeks were mightily impressed by this prophecy, and they started counting the days. In fact, Tecumseh was actually nowhere near Detroit, but when the first earthquake hit, and it coincided with what the Creeks had calculated as the time it should have taken Tecumseh to reach Detroit, and did indeed knock down the houses in this village, they thought, wow, this guy's got a lot of power. And it started at first a civil war among the Creek, and then in time a war against the United States government, which we refer to as the Creek War of 1813 and 14. It was actually the southern front of the War of 1812. People generally have forgotten that the War of 1812 was every bit as much a war against the Indians as it was against the British. On the northern front, the British and the Indians, Tecumseh's forces were allied in Upper Canada in the struggle. And in the south, it was the Creek Nation that fought against Andrew Jackson's people. So the earthquake prediction actually did set the Creek Nation on the path to war. The story of Thomas Jefferson's nephews involves the Lilburn and Isham Lewis, two brothers from the powerful Lewis family, nephews of Thomas Jefferson, who had transplanted from Virginia to western Kentucky in 1809 and 1810, and things did not go well for them there. They were on a pretty bleak downward spiral. The family fortune had been profligately wasted, and they were headed for the rocks. On December 15th, 1811, the two brothers committed a unspeakably brutal murder of one of their slaves, and when they forced the rest of the slaves to dismember the body and place the pieces of the body in the fireplace, they built a roaring fire. They went to bed, and at 2 a.m. on December 16th, you know, hours, literally, you know, 2 hours after the murder, the first earthquake hit. It extinguished the fire, preserved the body, and through an equally bizarre set of circumstances, the last earthquake brought the murder to light and resulted in, indirectly, the death of the two, their apprehension and the death of the two brothers.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Jay Feldman, our guest today. He is the author of When the Mississippi Ran Backwards, Empire, Intrigue, Murder, and the New Madrid Earthquakes. My name, Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener on the toll-free line in Eureka. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is a fascinating subject. I often hear this described in superlatives, and I wonder if I could answer a series of very short questions about just what I remember as it being described as.
Sure.
This earthquake was so powerful, it actually, I've heard it described as it rang church bells in New England. Is that true?
That is correct. In Boston, church bells rang.
I see. And the Mississippi River actually ran backwards?
What happened was twice, on two different occasions, a large piece of land, we're talking about acres and acres, miles and miles, block of land, was thrust up. And the land that was thrust up happened to cross the river. So you've got all this water flowing down river. It's like when you're in a bathtub and you push the water towards the end. It hits the other end of the bathtub. There's nowhere it can go but back towards you. So all this water rushing downriver hits this huge piece of land, and this happened twice now on two different occasions, hits this huge piece of land, and there's no place for it to go but backwards. So it has the effect of appearing that it's running backwards, upriver towards St. Louis. The effect of it was like a tsunami. It's not a tsunami because it's not an ocean phenomenon, and it's not created by the same conditions that would create a tsunami. But the effect is the same. You have a 30-foot-high wall of water running upstream, spreading out over the banks, flooding the area on either side of the river for miles and miles and miles. And the piece of the river that's been thrust up, of course, is unconsolidated sediment. It's very soft, sandy soil. So it's not very long before this is worn down and the river resumes its normal course. But yes, realistically or practically speaking, for a short time, the Mississippi did appear to run backwards. The current was retrograde.
And this created Real Foot Lake, is that right, too?
The third earthquake on February 7th, did create Real Foot Lake. That is correct.
Mm-hmm. One final question.
Sure.
There was a, I think it was a PBS documentary, The Making of a Continent. I believe I have it in my home videotape library, suggested that there is another huge one, possibly in the near future, and I guess they give I guess there's a seismological center at the University of Memphis and maybe other places that seem to indicate there are a lot. There are certain tremors that would indicate that this thing is going to go off again in a very big way. Do you have any opinion or any scientific evidence that supports any thought like that?
Well, let's leave the time factor alone for a while. We'll talk about that in a second. But let me talk about why there are earthquakes in the Mississippi Valley. You're probably familiar, excuse me, with the phenomenon called continental drift. A study of the Earth's crust reveals a cyclical process. Over the course of millions and billions of years, the continents drift together and slam up against one another and form a huge supercontinent, or maybe two supercontinents. And then over the course of millions and billions of years, they break up again, and they drift apart, and they float out on the oceans, and then they come back together, and then they break up again. During one of these breakups, the predecessor of North America, which geologists call Laurentia, was breaking up, and at that time the continent didn't look exactly the way it did today. What's now the Gulf of Mexico extended much further north, so that a large part of, well, all of Louisiana, parts of Alabama, parts of Mississippi, part of Arkansas, East Texas, were all underwater, under that body of water. At some point, at the top of that gulf, the continent started a new rift, as if that whole section of what we now know as North America was going to split off and drift apart and form a new continent of its own. So you can imagine everything from the Mississippi Valley eastward being a different continent. Well, the rift didn't complete itself. It stopped for some reason. Nobody knows why. Magma came bubbling up from below the crust, molten lava, spread out over this area. And as it cooled, in the same, kind of the same way that, you know, when you take a cake out of the oven under the wrong circumstances, it'll fall.
Mm-hmm.
The surface of the Earth fell. So now you've got this huge valley created by this rift, and that valley is 350 miles long and between 50 and 100 miles wide. Much, much later, when the inland sea that covered much of North America began to drain, that's the path it took, that path of least resistance through that valley. That became the Mississippi River and created the Mississippi Valley. Okay, so now you've got 3 miles of fill. The Mississippi brought down huge volumes of land with it, creating the previously non-existing what's now Louisiana, parts of Alabama, parts of Mississippi, Arkansas, and East Texas. And so you got 3 miles of depth of that silt and fill above the Rift Valley, which still exists, okay, and persists as an area of weakness. It's the area of greatest seismic weakness and risk east of the Rocky Mountains. All right, now, at the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, underneath the Atlantic Ocean, new crust is constantly being created. And as this crust is being forced up to the ocean bed, it's being pushed east and west at the same time in both directions. As it's being pushed west at the rate of, 2-3 centimeters a year, it's creating tremendous stress on the North American plate, the middle of which still has this rift valley which persists as a zone of weakness. It's a scar, and it's constantly moving and adjusting. And over the course of hundreds of years, these stresses build up. Unlike, say, in an area where the tectonic plates come together, like the west coast of the United States up through Alaska, where the plates are constantly bumping and grinding and pushing against one another, and so thereby creating a relatively high incidence of earthquake events out in the middle of the continent, in the intraplate fault. The incidence of high earthquakes is more separated, but when they go off in a big way. So, paleoseismological studies have shown that around 900 AD and again around 1450 AD, there were these huge series of events on what is called the New Madrid fault zone. And then again, we know around 1800. So every 350 to 450, 500 years, there's a big explosion around there. Now, as far as, okay, so we know it's inevitable. Okay, when it's going to happen, I don't think anybody knows. And I know people at the Memphis Center for Earthquake Research and Information, and I don't think any of them would tell you that huge, would venture a prediction as to when the next large series of events is going to happen. But I think they're all in agreement that it's going to happen. It could be tomorrow, it could be 300 years from now, but it is certainly inevitable.
Could I close with a comment? I remember when the last one was predicted, that it got all news media publicity and that schools were closed down. It said on WGN Radio, the 9 o'clock news, that whoever the person was went to a vacation to an undisclosed location. Thank you.
Yeah, right. That was 1990. It was Ibon Browning, and it created quite a stir and a good deal of alarm and panic in the throughout the Mississippi Valley.
Yeah. Well, just to also to underline how powerful the forces are at work here, in the sequence of the 1811-1812 earthquakes along the fault zone, there were 2,000 tremors. Now, I don't know how you figure that out, but that's what you report in the book when the Mississippi ran backwards. And
right.
You say, essentially, the earth was in perpetual motion.
Essentially, yes. The way we know that is there were two scientists, one in Cincinnati and one in Louisville, Kentucky, who kept records of these tremors. They had primitive seismological measuring, basically springs, that were sensitive enough to feel anything over, say, a 4.0, and they kept, there was one man in particular who kept very, very careful records right into the middle of April.
Hmm. Interesting. We have another listener waiting to talk with us in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I was very intrigued when you talked about the two brothers having done this hideous crime in a hideous way to kill one of their slaves. It seems that, as I understand the relationship between African-American slaves and the owners, that the owners could pretty much do what they wanted, though that is a disgusting concept to us. And I wonder what it was that brought these two brothers to justice.
Yeah, that's a very good point. It's true that slave owners had pretty wide latitude in how they chose to abuse their slaves. But there were limits. For example, if a slave owner, and laws varied from state to state, but basically if a slave owner killed one of his slaves while he was administering, quote, moderate, that's the word that's in the law, moderate correction. Well, you know, that was forgivable. He maybe went far, a little too far, but okay. Or if a slave was killed in the process of running away, that was also. But there were these limits, and while there was no specific black and white terminology, there was something about community standards that if an act was so reprehensible to community standards that there could be no possible justification for it. In addition to which, the societal influence of the slave owner came into play here. So you had these two guys who were already enjoying a reputation as not the most savory characters. And so all these factors came together to create the situation whereby, and in Kentucky especially, where conditions may have been a little bit better than they were in places like Mississippi, Alabama, and some of the other Deep South states, you had conditions which came together to create a horrified reaction among the white population, and basically that's the way it happened. And you're right, though, and you can imagine how horrible this crime must have been, that it would have even been, considered prosecutable.
Well, don't tell me, but I am glad that they did meet justice.
Yeah, not through the courts.
Oh, not through the courts.
No, there's a more interesting story than that, and I don't want to, take up a lot more time on it, but if you read the book, you'll see it was. I mean, the courts did come into play, but they never did come to trial. One of them committed suicide, the other ran away, and was actually one of 13 Americans killed in the Battle of New Orleans, which was the last battle of the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. One of those kind of like perfect exclamation point codas that writers, live for. If we could, Celeste, I would like to talk about another story that we haven't touched on at all, which is the Steamboat New Orleans.
Yes, right.
This is another rather incredible coincidence involving the ancestors of Theodore Roosevelt, the great-granduncle and great-grandaunt of Theodore Roosevelt, named Nicholas and Lydia Roosevelt, who built the very first steamboat ever to travel the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. This was, remember, only 3 years after Robert Fulton's Clermont successfully negotiated the Hudson River in New York. And there was a lot of skepticism about whether a steamboat could handle the western rivers, which were admittedly more dangerous and with much more trickier currents and hazards than the Hudson. So the Roosevelts set out to prove that it could be done. Lydia Roosevelt in herself was a remarkable person. The year before the steamboat voyage, she and her husband took a flatboat voyage from Pittsburgh to New Orleans to gauge the rivers and get an idea whether the project was feasible. Well, she was pregnant during that trip. When she reached New Orleans, when the flatboat reached New Orleans, she was 8 months pregnant. They returned to New York, and she gave birth to a daughter. The next year, when they left Pittsburgh, she was 8 months pregnant with her second child, undertook this steamboat voyage at that point, gave birth to the to a son in Louisville, and so she's just one of these amazing women who you read about these pioneer women. Well, she takes the cake. in any case, the steamboat New Orleans. Here's the most important point. Was on its maiden voyage, the first steamboat voyage ever on the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. Well, it was caught in the earthquakes. It weathered the earthquakes exceptionally well because of its huge size and stability, whereas all other boats on the river were just tossed about like toys in a bathtub. And so the fact that the New Orleans did well, not only with the rivers, but with the earthquake, was that much more proof that earthquakes could handle this voyage. And in fact, in a very short time, steamboat travel became the currency of the day in getting from the East Coast to the West Coast. Before that, a very arduous journey over, I didn't mean the West Coast, I meant New Orleans, the western side of the Mississippi River. But before that, a very arduous journey over the Allegheny Mountains had to be undertook at great expense and hardship. So the success of the steamboat voyage played a major role in further opening the West, because now people essentially could hop on a boat, get out to Missouri and Arkansas, get on a wagon, and move further westward. So that just created a further opening for the manifest destiny you referred to earlier.
Yeah. And also it's another point where we begin to, as Americans, celebrate technology, I suppose.
Well, it's the very American thing about technology. You know, we kind of like can mark our, if you want to call it, advance as a people by technological invention. And this technology, steam technology, really, you know, just pushed westward movement forward by if I can be corny here, a seismic leap.
Mm. And the rivers were the highways of the day. So in order to, you could reach the frontier fairly quickly and easily, you were well on your way.
That's true. The rivers were the avenue for commerce, transportation, and news. That's the way everything traveled. The difference between being able to get on a steamboat and not only downriver, but particularly upriver travel.
Right.
Going against the current was something that was not a whole lot of fun in a flatboat. Whereas in a steamboat, it's just, you know, a matter of, firing up the boilers.
Oh. Speaking of news, how did word of the quakes get back east?
Well, excuse me. The quakes were felt back east, remember. They were felt in Washington, D.C. They were felt in North Carolina, South Carolina. They were felt in Boston and New York. And by the time the news appeared in the newspapers of the the Ohio and Mississippi Valley, it was not very long before people put two and two together, and that news traveled, you know, fairly quickly from, say, Pittsburgh, you know, from Louisville and Pittsburgh, you know, back to the East Coast, and everybody went, ah, that's what we felt.
Mm.
Because in New Madrid and the area, they knew it was earthquake. I mean, at first, okay, imagine 2 a.m., the first earthquake hits on December 16th. These people thought it was the end of the world. I mean, they had no idea. Of course, by the morning, with the continuing quakes, they figured out. I mean, they knew what earthquakes were. There were earthquakes, recorded earthquakes, in the United States before that. But at the beginning, my goodness, they had no no concept of what was happening, and there was really, it really was this apocryphal reaction to it.
And people got religion there for a while.
There was a huge religious revival, which lasted basically through the earthquakes. The Western Methodist Church increased its membership, I think, fivefold in the next couple of years. But unfortunately, as the quakes receded, so did the fervor dropped off. They called them earthquake Christians, and people went back to their sinful ways in a short time.
Yeah.
But yes, there was a great religious revival for a bit there.
Yeah. And the earthquakes weren't the only unusual phenomena of 1811. Apparently, there was all this other stuff going on at the same time.
Yeah, 1811 is referred to in history as Annus Mirabilis, the year of wonders, in which there were volcanoes and floods and fires and animal migrations and plagues. It was just one of those strange times in history when many, many things happened, coincidentally or not, who knows.
Mm.
And these earthquakes were kind of the culmination. Very shortly after the last of the major New Madrid earthquakes, in March 1812, there was a huge earthquake in Caracas, Venezuela, that killed tens of thousands of people. Had the New Madrid area and the Mississippi Valley been populated to a greater extent than it was at the time, there's no question that there would have been thousands and thousands of deaths. If and when, well, not if, but when the next series happens in this area, there could be very, very serious number of casualties.
Mm.
Just to give you an idea of how sparsely populated that area was, at the time, St. Louis had 2,000 people. If the epicenter of any of the quakes had been closer to St. Louis, certainly more people would have died.
Yeah. And then you think back to the impact that this had on politics in the 19th century, and how the War of 1812 and the Indian Wars built the reputations of future American leaders.
Yeah.
You know, you wonder, some kind of huge catastrophe like this, what would it mean today for the political landscape?
Yeah, I'm sure there would be all kinds of fallout. The very first Federal Disaster Relief Act in the nation's history was written in 1815 for the victims of the New Madrid earthquake. Unfortunately, it turned out to be a bit of a disaster in itself because all kinds of sharp characters went down there claiming land and buying up deeds, and the resulting lawsuits tied up the courts for a half century. The last of the New Madrid claims was settled in 1862, and for a long time, the very term New Madrid claim took on the colloquial meaning of bogus or fraud. In other words, as phony as a $3 bill, as phony as a New Madrid claim.
Mm. And once upon a time, New Madrid was supposed to be utopia.
It was created by a very remarkable man named George Morgan as a planned utopia. It didn't work out that way because another remarkable scoundrel named James Wilkinson basically intervened to crush Morgan's plan, but New Madrid nevertheless got built, and nevertheless it was a major point on the Mississippi River, in a strategic stopping off place because of its location on that large bend in the river.
Yeah. What is now the Boot Heel of?
The Boot Heel of Missouri.
Missouri, correct. Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Jay Feldman, thank you very much for joining me this afternoon and talking with me and our listeners.
Oh, you're very kind to have invited me.
Oh, well, this is a great story. It's so artfully told as well. And I want to thank you again. Jay Feldman, our guest this afternoon, the author of When the Mississippi Ran Backwards, Empire, Intrigue, Murder, and the New Madrid Earthquakes. The book is published by the Free Press. And that interview was from May 12th of this year. The interview that we had scheduled with Carol Burke today about her book Camp All American, Hanoi, Jane Ann, The High and Tight, Gender, Folklore, and Changing Military Culture, we rescheduled that. She will join us June 29th. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade for the afternoon, after USDA's release of the WASDE, the World Agricultural and Supply and Demand Estimates today, futures finished like this, despite the fact that the numbers showed fewer soybeans would be around by the end of this year. Beans were down about 7 cents in the nearby contracts. The deferred was down a nickel. In the wheat pit, we'll start with them, just like we always do, for the full look at the marketplace. July futures today had a high of 318.75. The low there was at $3.13 and a settlement price at 313.5. They were down 0.75 cents for the day. September futures, 328.75 on the high, the low at 323.5. Settled at $3.24.5, they were unchanged. December contract in the wheat pit, 340.5, the high, the low at 335. Settlement price at 335.5, down a quarter. And the March contract, 349.5, the high, the low at 347, settled at $3.48.25, down 0.75. From the corn pit, July futures, 217.75, the high, the low at 209, settled at 210, down 5.5. That 209, by the way, was the low for this week. September futures, 227.5, the high, the low at 219.5, settlement price at $2.20.25, down 4.75. And December futures, 236.25, the high, the low at 229.25, settled $2.30.25, down 4.25. March contract in the corn pit, 244, the high, the low at 238, settled 238.25, down 4.25, and the May contract at 245, high, low at 242.25, settled $2.43 for the May corn next year, down 3.25. July futures of next year, 251.25, the high, the low at 246.75, settlement price at 247.25, down 0.75. During the closing market report this afternoon, not only will we talk with Mike Zuzolo of Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana, but we'll hear an interview that I did earlier today with University of Illinois Extension ag economist Darrell Good. Be sure to stay tuned with that this afternoon during the closing market report. Picks up around 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today. July oats now, 143.25 the high, low at 141.5, settled at 142.75. They were unchanged. September, 147 high, low at $1.45, settled up on that high at $1.47 a bushel for the September oats. They were down a half cent for the day. Soy complex now, nearby beans, $6.79 the high, the low at 664.5, settled at 666.25. Down 7 cents today. August futures, 681.5, the high, the low at 668. Settlement price at 669.5. They were down 6.75. This all despite the fact that USDA released a ending stocks figure for this year that's 35 million bushels lower than it was in May. September contract now, 684.5, the high, the low at 670. Settlement price at 671, down 6.75. November futures, $6.89, the high, the low at 676. Settlement price there at $6.78. They were down 6.25. And the January, 689, the high, the low at 677. Settlement price at 678 and a quarter, down 6. March beans at 679, the high, the low at 671, and a settlement price at 673, down 5. USDA, by the way, saying the crush is up 25 million bushels and exports are 10 million bushels higher for the beans. That's how they came to that 35 million extra bushels that won't be in the cupboard by the time we get to the end of this marketing year this fall. July bean meal, 215.50, the high, the low at 210.80. Settled 211.40. They were up, rather down 150 for the day. The August meal down a dollar, 215.80, the high, the low at 211.50. Settled 212.40. Once again, it was down a dollar. July bean oil for the day, 23.20, the high, the low at 22.72. Settled 22.74, off 39 for the day. And the August contract in the bean oil pit, 23.28, the high, the low at 22.82. Soybean oil finished the August futures at $22.83. They were off 41 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Another lower day today for livestock prices. August feeder cattle, the high today, 111.85, the low 111.02.5, the settlement 111.25. That finished up a nickel. September feader cattle, 110.60, the high 109.90, the low, the settlement 110.07.5. That contract finished down 2.5. October 108.95, the high 108.45, the low, the settlement 108.60, that down 2.5. June live cattle 84.30, the high 83.70, the low 83.80, the settlement up 17.5. August live cattle 82.60, the high 82 even, the low 82.12.5, the settlement that unchanged. June lean hogs 67.67.5, the high 67.20, the low 67.25, the settlement that up 7.5. July 69.70, the high 68.25, the low 68.32.5, the settlement that down 52.5. August lean hog 68.65, the high 67.70, the low 67.97.5, the settlement that down a nickel. And October lean hogs 59.82.5, the high 59 even, the low 59.05, the settlement that down 12.5. July belly 71.50, the high 68.30, the low, the settlement 69.25, that down 135. The Dow is off 45 points at 10,458. The NASDAQ down 19 at 2058. The S&P 500 off 8 at 1193.
The Carle Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carle Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Mrs. Favell Mortimer published The Countries of Europe Described as a sort of primer for children in the mid-1800s.
It's a collection of very nasty Victorian children's writing about geography, written by somebody who didn't get out very much.
Here's what she had to say about Poland.
You may go a great way without seeing anything pretty.
The misanthropic travel writer, later on All Things Considered, from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 7 on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano.